Welcome to the Big 60s Sort Out, brought to you by the Big Beatles Sort Out. We've spent three series so far sorting the Beatles, and now we're turning our attention to the competition, the context, the bigger picture. Who are they up against? What music influenced them? And will we hear the shockwaves of the Beatles' epic success as we sort all the UK number ones from the 1960s by ranking them for music, lyrics and production? Thanks for joining us as we try and sort out the 60s. Welcome to Series 4, Episode 1. I'm Gary Abbott, author, musician, podcaster, and please welcome my music expert brother, Paul, here we go again, Abbott.
We certainly do. Hello, everybody. It's lovely to be back here in a brand new year for us and a look back 64 years in time yes. For this first episode, really. I hope you're all recovering from very happy New Year's. We don't know when this is going out yet, but it'll probably be near to New Year, won't it? You know, sometime around then.
We're hoping so.
Yeah, so I hope, you know, you've had lovely New Year's, lovely hogmanays flying around in your kilts and sporrans, you know, all that sort of thing. Because that's what we're going to be looking at as well. It's not like this is going to line up with the times that the episodes come out, how we do this. But for this one,
it will.
Start of 1960, it's the start of 2024. So, yeah.
Yes, yes.
Happy New Year and hello. It's nice to be back.
Yes, it certainly is nice to be back. If you haven't already, we did a Series 4 Episode 0 where we explain in much more detail than I'm about to what we're about to do here and for the next many weeks, we think.
Many weeks.
But, you know, if you're joining us for the first time, I'd recommend going and listen to that episode. But if you're coming back to us as a Beatles fan, please listen and take in why we're coming at this angle. I'm hope you know you come for the ride with us, but we'll recap a little bit. Basically, we've spent three series ranking all the Beatles songs and movies and extras and some of their solo work from the 70s, and we've frankly run out of Beatles stuff to rank, but we wanted to carry on and we wanted to talk about that era, that decade, where they fit in. Because there wasn't just the Beatles and nothing else. There was a whole world going on around them. And we thought the best way to do it was give the same treatment as we did to the Beatles, rank the songs that were hitting number one throughout that decade, which will include the Beatles when we get to them. And then we'll revisit what I gave them before and we'll put them in this new context. And we're going to do that, four or five songs an episode. I mean, Paul, do you want to give us the technical terms, the reference that we're working within, just to...
Well, yeah, just very quickly, basically, we are using the official charts as they stand now. So there's no Please Please Me, I'm afraid. It's the charts that have been adopted as of the end of the 60s into the 70s, the Record Retailer and then Music Week chart, basically. And that's guiding what we're doing. So it gives us 187 number ones of the 1960s.
Ooh, that's a plenty to get on with. You've
got to keep us going. We're going to divide up the episodes, as Gary says, into either five or four songs, probably, just so that we don't cross over a year end.
Yeah, we'd like to get a nice...
Basically, so we can do it in nice little blocks of months. Months and years and things like that. Not months, yeah, years. Anyway, it'll be tidy, it'll be neat, you'll like it. You'll be able to put it on a shelf and it won't... you'll be able to stack them next to each other, these podcasts.
Yeah, they're not all going to come out in different size special edition box sizes.
Yeah. Imagine a group... that would put out all their special edition boxes. Yeah, so you know, the virtual box sets of these years of the 60s are all going to be exactly uniform.
Yeah.
So that's good, isn't it, really? And the only other thing to add is, of course, the Beatles are the most studied and written about group in history.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of the people we're talking about aren't.
Yes.
Well, in fact, by definition, all of them aren't if they're not the Beatles. But some of them are very unstudied and there's not much about them, despite the internet. So we'll do our best here. Mm. There won't be as much technical detail on production, you know, granular sort of detail. No. It's going to be much more of a subjective response, I suspect.
Yeah. We and won't have spent
the fine.
Time.
That's fine.
Yeah. There might be some later down the line, but definitely there's going to be quite a lot that we won't have spent much time with beyond... our listen for this, I think that's fine.
There'll be some interesting names who'll keep cropping up as well, and that'll perhaps help us build the sort of production side picture of it, I think.
Yes.
There's lots to look forward to in this, and I'm really pleased because, as ever, the 60s has that sort of annoying swirly font psychedelic face to it in sort of popular culture, the Austin Powers-esque approach to it. And that's not the 60s at all. It's a much more complicated decade than that in terms of creativity and the who and the why and the what. So that's going to be really interesting.
Is that three bands from the 60s there you just mentioned?
The who, the why and the what. All on the same bill together.
Two of them we don't really hear much of anymore. I mean, but the what, they're doing brilliantly.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's going to be great. It's going to be interesting. We'll see how it goes, and it'll be fun, and we're going to stick with it anyway because that's the kind of people we are. One thing I need to do is the Gubbins. So please keep in touch with us on Twitter and Instagram at big_sort or email us at bigbeetlesortout@gmail.com. And please like, subscribe and review our little show if you would be so kind on whatever platform you are listening. They seem to be rapidly closing. All the podcast platforms I use keep on closing down. But I'm sure there's some big ones left. Also, please consider dropping by garyabbott.bandcamp.com and goodgriefliverpool.bandcamp.com, which I'll put in the episode links every week, to support us in our own musical endeavours. Because that would be nice too.
It would be nice because everything that someone actually buys from a band now is a lot more money, relatively speaking, than you're ever going to get off the streamers.
Yeah.
So, if you're listening to this on Spotify, don't. Take it down, throw Spotify in the sea and listen to it on something else.
Yeah, and consider grabbing a CD. Mine are only £5 at the moment, so as I get ready for my next release. So, you know, and I'll sign a little thing and throw some plectrums in. Anyway, so we used to do a feature in the first two series, or all three of them, I think, called On This Beatles Day, where Paul would relay a Beatles fact from this day in history. But it's going to be a little different, obviously, this time, Paul. So what are we going to have? What are we going to have instead?
We're going to do On This Anthony Newley Day.
What?
No, we're not. No, we're not. Although I'm sure that would be very, very interesting. I'm going to carry on doing a little bit of Beatles history. So what we want to do is look for all the opportunities to keep us Beatles fans interested with what were the Beatles getting up to during the period of the songs we're covering in the episodes.
Yeah.
And also whenever I can find a little link elsewhere. And there's quite a lot, obviously, especially after, say, 1963.
Yeah.
Where they were in the orbit of a lot of the other people as more than before. So we'll do that. And I have got, so for this episode, we're covering five songs between January 1960, the very start of the decade, and mid-March 1960.
Okay.
Do you want me to just do it now?
Yeah, sorry. There was a big pause there.
Sorry, you were sort of asking me to set out my stall.
Oh, no, well, set out your stall and then start selling things to people.
Okay, I'll sell you some Beatles history here. Okay, January 1960 to mid-March 1960, we have no Beatles.
No.
What we do have is Quarrymen.
Ah, that's where we have.
Yeah, we have the very last throes of the band being the Quarrymen, essentially, in this block, literally, to about mid-March. It's John Lennon, who's at art school.
Mm-hmm.
It's Paul McCartney, who's at school doing his A-levels. George Harrison, who's gone off to work in Blacklers. And a chap called Ken Brown, who was the only one of them who actually owned an amp.
Right.
And it's kind of a bit like, well, the amp's more in the band than Ken is, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they had a residency at the Casbah Club. Even before Pete was drumming with them, they had this residency at the Casbah.
Hmm.
And there was one time when Ken Brown felt too ill to play. So Mona Best says, that's fine. You go and do the door. You go and sit on the door, do the, you know, paying in and all that stuff. And at the end of the session, she says, well, I'm going to pay Ken as well. And the other Quarrymen are like, no, you didn't play. And she insists. That's the end of them at the Casbah and the end of Ken Brown in the band as well.
Was that the instigating event, is it?
Yeah, basically.
They fall out with them for paying him and for him for being paid?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because he wasn't playing, because he wasn't feeling well. But, you know, so there goes Ken. There goes Ken's amp.
Oh, no, they lost the amp. Imagine if the Beatles had never had an amp for the rest of their career.
Well, a lot of the time in this period, they didn't, really. If anyone's going to pick on me for any of these sources or dates or anything. I am basically, for the early years, obviously going to use the Mark Lewis and stuff, and I'm not trying to rehash it. We're just trying to get some broad strokes
here.
And talking about broad strokes, there's an art school student called Dave May who is asked if he wants to play bass with the band, but he's in what he apparently calls a good group and says no.
Okay.
But on the 17th of January 1960, Stu Sutcliffe sells a painting to John Moores after the annual art exhibition closes, and he gets 90 quid for it.
Wow.
Which is a lot of money in 1960, especially for a teenager. And so they keep nagging him, the rest of the Quarrymen then keep nagging him, going, why don't you either get a drum kit or get a bass?
Mm.
And eventually he agrees to join on a bass guitar.
And he goes
and buys one, which probably cost about 60 quid, which is a lot of the 90 quid and a lot of money for a bass guitar. You know, it's a lot of, it's more money than I've paid for a bass guitar, relatively speaking.
Yeah, relatively, because my first bass, if I remember rightly, and my Marlin Sidewinder.
Yeah, your Marlin Sidewinder.
My silver one was about 90 quid.
Yeah, and that was in what, 1994,
early
5?
90s. Yeah, early 90s at some point.
Oh yeah, perhaps like that.
And yeah.
And that's when 90 quid was worth 90 quid.
Yeah.
As opposed to 90 quid being worth about £1,800 or something
It's
mad, isn't it?
Yeah. For someone who then didn't really go on to really learn it very well.
Yeah, and he got it on hire purchase, and that's how people got hold of these instruments. So you get it on hire purchase, you know, put away a little bit each week or whatever.
Right.
And it's also around the period where John moves out of Aunt Mimi's house on Menlove Avenue, and he goes into a flat on Gambier Terrace with Stu and Rod Murray. And that's very close to the Art College.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing building, that Gambier Terrace, opposite the cathedral. And also around this time, we get the situation where Paul, who's gone out with a girl called Dot, he gets her pregnant around this time.
I did not
so,
know
that. A bit of drama here. We'll see what happens with that.
Okay.
I don't want to make it sound like a soap opera, because these
are real.
Are real people with real things that happened.
Yeah.
But what are you asking, Gary? Ringo?
Asking for some Beatles facts. For
sorry, Ringo at this point is obviously in Rory Storm of the Hurricanes.
Yes.
Around this time, they do a show at the Cavern Jazz Festival.
Mm-hmm.
So the Cavern wasn't always the mecca of rock and roll that it becomes.
No.
They don't go down well at all, because they're playing rock in a jazz club. But Alan Williams, him of the Jacaranda, finds himself in Hamburg.
Okay.
That's when plans are starting to be made to get groups from the UK going over to Hamburg.
Oh, we'll see what happens with that in the next.
Yeah, there's lots of dangling threads here, isn't there?
Yeah. That's interesting. But, these little cutscenes that are going to converge.
Indeed, yeah. And just to add a little extra thing, so John and George for definite go and see Eddie Cochran and Gene Vincent at the Liverpool Empire in March.
Okay.
Which is interesting. You've got to keep in mind, so even though, you know, they're not moving in the circles of the stars as equals or other performers, they would be going out to see the big live acts that they liked when they came across. Although not always, because apparently John preferred the sound of the records to the sound of the live shows.
Okay.
And I can understand it, you know, perhaps with the technology of the time.
Yes,
really.
That's a good point, seeing as they only had an amp between them.
Well, I think Eddie Cochran had more than one amp, but, you know.
Yeah, we'll see.
So there you go. The start of the 1960s, the start of the 60s for the not Beatles, the Quarrymen.
Oh, I like that, Paul. I like that.
Hmm.
That's the seeds of the four series Netflix drama I want someone to make one day, with, you know, bringing the Beatles right from the, you know, the beginnings of.
They can make it with AI now. Just put it in AI.
Okay, yeah, makes it even easier.
AI.com, Beatles series
drama, please. Yeah, no, very good. I enjoyed that. So let's go and have a listen then to some of these songs that they would have been hearing on the radio, and presumably as people who wanted to be musicians and at some point top the charts would have been thinking, I can do that, or I could do that better.
Yes, I suspect there'd be quite a lot of what we're going to hear in the next couple of episodes, it'll be things that they did not like.
Exactly. Well, that's important too, isn't it? That they will listen and go, I'm better than that because my music is better than that.
Yeah.
So, and we'll see. We'll see. So, the first song we're going to listen to, Paul, is Emil Ford and the Checkmates. What do you want to make those eyes at me for?
What do you want to make those eyes at me for? If they don't mean what they say, they make me glad, they make me sad, they make me want a lot of things that I never had. You fool.
What do you want to make those eyes at me for, Paul?
Well, I use these eyes so I can look at the words I'm about to tell you, and that is that this is our bridging song from the 50s, the last number one of the 50s, the first number one of the 60s.
So this ushered in the new year. So was it a Christmas number one or?
Yeah, it would have been. Yeah, It was 6 weeks at number one, starting mid-December of 1959.
Blimey!
So, and it was a big hit. And there's a lot to be interested in here. I think one of the most important things to think about this is a song that is probably from about 1916.
1916?
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's the first number one hit of the 60s is a redo of an old song, a really old song, even by that time.
Yeah.
So it's a bonkers thing, really. But let me tell you some of the facts here. It comes out on the record label Pi, and it's actually, technically, it's a B-side.
Okay.
So our first hit is actually not the hit it's supposed to be. The hit's supposed to be Don't Tell Me Your Troubles, which is the A-side.
Right.
But the pressure from Emil Ford and from the people who listened to it was basically meant that the exposure all goes on to What Do You Want to Make Those Eyes at Me For? Which, having listened to both sides of the disc, is the better song.
I'll take your word for it.
So the song originally written by James V. Monaco, Joseph McCarthy, Howard Johnson. Like I say, this is a long time ago. And it's produced by Emil Ford himself.
Wow.
Probably with Joe Meek. And we'll come back to Joe Meek in future things. But yeah, this is a huge success story, this really. So there's a vocal group competition happens in August of 1959. Mm-hmm. Or before August 1959, and Emil Ford and the Checkmates win this competition, which is run by one of the music mags at the time. And Pi Records go, well, we'll have them then.
Yeah.
Which is good for them.
Well, yeah.
And what's even better for them is the fact that it's got Emil Ford in the group, who essentially, I mean, bless the Checkmates, but they kind of drop away by this point, even though they're named on the record and they're playing on the record, really, it was all about Emil Ford.
Yeah.
And that's not just because it's him singing, but it's him producing. And he basically he'd come to London to study at Paddington Technical College from the West Indies, and he just loved sound reproduction, acoustics, audio technology, and that's what he makes into his actual life's work, essentially.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's sometimes funny to, you know, these are just names. It's like, oh, Emil Ford did that first song. It's like, yeah, but it's really interesting. He was involved in the production side of it as well.
Which is no small thing, especially at that time, is it? It's not like now where any old Tom, Dick or Harry can be a producer in the sense that you can download something for free and start producing music.
No, you had to go off and study it. You had to take it from an electronics approach as much as anything.
Heavy hardware, didn't you?
Yeah, you need to be able to get into a situation where you can access this stuff, and even better if you could make it and maintain it yourself.
Wow.
So the Checkmates were George Sweetenham Ford, who was his half-brother on bass, Dave Sweetenham Ford, also half-brother, on sax, Ken Street on guitar, and John Cuffley on drums. And it's such a big hit of a single, it makes Emil Ford the first black artist in the UK to have a million seller.
Wow.
So it's a huge hit, really. And then, like I say, he goes on afterwards, after a few more hits, he keeps performing, but he goes on to be an acoustics engineer. He basically invents karaoke.
He invents karaoke?
Yeah.
What did he... Why? Not why, but how?
Basically, he invents a system for live playback of backing tracks on stage.
Okay.
So that people could sing along with them in performance situations. You know, so goodbye the checkmates. We've got the recording. We don't need you. Which is essentially the technology that's used to popularise karaoke as the years go by.
Isn't that just playing the music with a microphone on stage? What's the difference?
Well, except that, is it going through the same system as the microphone? Is it going to cause feedback? All that sort of stuff.
Okay.
So he had a patent on a system called the Liviotech Sound Frequency Feedback Injection System.
Ooh.
A feedback inhibitor. More than that, I cannot tell you.
No.
But, you know, that's just amazing stuff, really.
Excellent. Well, there you go. A plethora of facts and interesting things already.
What about a Beatles one?
Have you got a Beatles one?
Yeah, I have. Before we get stuck into your rankings.
Go on then.
So the Beatles played with him a couple of times.
Oh, yeah.
So there's quite a famous couple of pictures of him. He sat behind a drum kit backstage at in New Brighton at the Tower Ballroom, and he's sort of prodding Paul and Pete in the armpits under their leather jackets with the drumsticks.
Right.
So, yeah, I think they played together in November of 1961, where the Hurricanes were backing him.
Okay. And as in then, Rory Storm and the Hurricanes?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So Ringo
would
have been there. And then they play again in 6th of April. And, yeah, so, you know, their paths crossed a couple of times in the years following this, even before the Beatles were the Beatles.
Ah. So I mean, it's bound to happen, isn't it? You know, but...
like I say, there was a touring circuit, and it wasn't just play London, play Manchester, play Glasgow or something like it is with big acts now.
Yeah.
It's everywhere. It's all a theatre around, it's they a theatre circuit.
People even used to play here in Stoke, Paul.
Oh, yeah. We'll get onto that at some point.
Where I live, for any new listeners, Paul is in the hallowed land of Liverpool.
The hard land of Liverpool?
Hallowed.
Oh, right, I was going to say.
And hard.
I thought, well, you've just spent the weekend up here. I thought you've come away going, it's very hard up there. Very hard land.
Hard life. Brilliant. Okay, shall I get on with my rankings then?
Let's do it.
So, first up, we always start with music. And I think it's a good start to have some, well, I'd say proper doo-wop because of the backing. We actually have the words doo-wop to dooby-wooby in the backing.
Yeah, which, definitely.
So it's probably the definition of doo-wop. But like you've said, interestingly, converted from a much earlier song. So I'm imagining that the 1907 version didn't...
1916.
The 1916 version didn't go doo-wop, dooby-wooby in the background, did it?
No, I found quite a few clippings about the... where it comes from. So in the Daily Mail of the 11th of August 1917, we have Herman Darevsky Music Publishing Company published the entire music of C.B. Cochrane's great new production at the Oxford that has taken London by storm, and this production is called The Better Owl.
The Better
Owl, apostrophe O-L-E.
Oh, like old?
No, like hole, I think.
Oh, right.
Like just a dropped H from the word hole.
Okay.
But I don't know, because it's not like I rushed out and got the book for this, by Captain Bruce Bairnsfather. Oh, that's a good name, isn't it? Bairnsfather. And Captain Arthur Elliott, music by Herman Darevsky. And then there's a list of names, and then the biggest song that's listed at the top of it is What Do You Want to Make Those Eyes at Me For?
Right.
And I think it actually came from an earlier play that was called Follow Me in America from the year before, and it's just been sort of dropped into this selection to make this new show on in London there. But yeah, I suspect it wasn't as doo-wop in 1916-17.
I'd love to be able to hear it. I'll have to look it up after this now.
I'd tell you what, I did find a copy of the sheet music from the period. And, in terms of words, music, chords, exactly the same.
Oh, okay. You know,
it's just arrangement that's made the difference.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. Well, did they have the key change? Because my next note was about the nice key change between the first and second verse, which makes the whole
song... No, they don't have that.
Yeah, because that's a very much a pop sensibility thing to do, isn't it? It's interesting to hear that even back in, early 1960, a good old key change was making things go to number one or helping things go to number one.
It's a funny key change as well, because literally it moves up a semitone. So it goes from a C to a C sharp in terms of the root key. So it's just like it just goes, just up a little bit.
Just
whoa.
A little ghost, just like a little ghost is there.
Yeah, little tiny ghosty.
And I like the classic kind of plonky walking bass and the kind of kind of heavy snare backing to the point where I'm not sure if I can hear any other kit other than the snare, but that's to do with
it's very snare driven, yeah. Especially because there's a standout individual snare that marks the end of sections.
Yeah, just
goes like on its own. And if you see the video of him performing it live, he does this thing where he sort of swipes his hand across to the left as if he's smacking something when that snare makes that noise.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay. Yeah, you can't really hear much kick or cymbals in there or anything else, really. It's kind of the voices, the bass and the snare, isn't it, really? And maybe some piano or guitar is there behind it all, but it's all...
Yeah, I mean, it's production, really, but it's very drenched in reverb, so a lot of the detail of the guitars are lost, but there is stuff in there as well.
But in their choice of instrumentation and arrangement of the music, you know, the walking bass line is very nice, the close harmonies creating the main texture behind the kind of prominent lead vocal is very nicely delivered. I like I like the key change and the show busy outro.
The false ending.
That's it, the false ending where it kind of, yeah, it's hard to describe a false ending without just singing it. You'll go and listen to it, you know what we mean. You get one more round of doo-wops after a kind of like a final snare rim and a kind of type of outro, don't you?
It's good.
You can imagine jazz hands is what I'm saying. Easily imagine jazz hands. But it is relatively simple.
It's two minutes and 4 seconds long. It doesn't last very long.
No, and it's early days, and I'm thinking about scoping this chart. And although it's catchy, you know, and I do like doo-woppy kind of stuff, this isn't floating my boat massively, so I'm going to give it 40 for music.
Okay.
And, you know, I think I've got to put it. This is the hardest couple of episodes, these first couple, where I put some lines in the sand, you know, to build
from.
If
you're thinking of all of the 60s that you're going to build from, and you're starting with a song from 1916.
Yes, exactly, yeah. It hasn't changed in chords or anything. So onto production, which we talked about a bit, and I'm sure we'll
Go on, sorry. I was ready to leap in there because I'm excited about this. Why have they left the 4 hi-hat clicks at the start of it?
I don't know. Maybe
it's really weird.
A bit like Now and Then, someone's thought.
Yeah, it is a bit like that. It is like 1, 2, 3. But normally, you'd have the drummer do a click to count you in all on time.
And cut it.
And usually that gets cut off, snipped off, snip, 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 snippety. But they've just left it in really loud, sup, 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 and then it starts. And I was thinking, is it just one version that's on streaming? But nope, every version. So don't know what that's all about.
Yes, but apart from that, I'm sure we're going to get a lot of in these early years and beyond, is Treble City. This kind of like everything is drowned in this trebly kind of...
It's the wash that the reverb makes. So if we think... I mentioned Joe Meek as one of the producers, although Emil Ford has been quoted saying that Joe Meek had nothing to do with it, but I suspect he has got something to do with it. And like I say, we'll talk about Joe Meek again, but if you're familiar with Joe Meek productions, you know, reverb features.
Right.
So there's a few little things on here you'd go, oh yeah, I can imagine Joe Meek doing that. But it does create a bit of a washy sort of
it starts
effect.
To, it suits the voices really well, but when everything's in at the same time, it all starts to get shrill and kind of too trebly and too washy. It's good.
And also the vocals are recorded, the lead vocal is recorded really hot. You know, so the mic gain is up or he's really on the mic or something like that, and it really breaks up there, so it's quite brittle sort of.
And as I said, because of all this, you know, you can't really make out much but the snare and the bass and the voices, and I feel like there could almost be a whole other band there somewhere hiding behind the frequencies, but we don't really hear it. And sometimes...
You know what you need to do? You need to get Peter Jackson to separate it out.
Yeah. I'm sure he'd turn his attention to this.
He'll get around to it eventually.
But sometimes that's going to suit... It's not just to say that everything in the early 60s we're going to cover is going to be like this, because sometimes it suits things, you know, from some of the ones I've already been listening to, and sometimes it's overdone. So it was a choice. And it does hit to an extent, but it does all get a little bit lost at times. I'm going to give it 30 for production.
Oh, gosh.
But, you know, I don't know what to say.
That's fine.
Yeah. Lyrics then. So, lyrics. I always like to do a good old breakdown of the lyrics. So I'll just go through them. What do you want to make those eyes at me for? If they don't mean what they say, they make me glad, they make me sad, they make me want a lot of things that I never had. You're fooling around with me now. Well, you lead me on, then you run away. Well, that's all right. I'll get you alone some night. And baby, you'll find you're messing with dynamite. So what do you want to make those eyes at me for if they don't mean what they say? Are those the same lyrics then from 1916?
Yep.
Blimey. So we essentially have one verse and one chorus repeated. I like the verse, especially the beat of the last line and how it rolls off the rhyme from sad. They make me glad, they make me sad, they make me want a lot of things that I never had. That's quite good.
They make me want a lot of things that I never had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The chorus is a little
didn't get
more,
the tune quite right there, but never mind.
Yeah, it sounded a bit like the Poddington Peas when you the chorus is a little more risky than the verse. Something about I'll get you alone some night and baby you'll find you're messing with dynamite. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a bit raunchy.
It's perhaps not good coupled with the general idea of the song being a man not being able to interpret signals.
Yeah, well,
because that's
get prepared for some of that as the exactly. It's as a bit the like, years roll by.
It's a bit you tease, isn't it? Which is a bit like you know. But yeah, and like I said, I'm sure this won't be the last time we say the words of its time. But I think this is a fairly meek example of that, and gives a theme to what was obviously a chart topper. But I'm not going to say any of this is, you know, is amazing stuff. So it's got 35 for lyrics.
Okie doke, yes. I mean, it's very slight. It's very, very slight.
And this is the thing. If anyone hasn't listened to my rankings from previous episodes, you always have to remember that I don't generally mean... I'm very forgiving, but I reserve the very top for really, really, really good music, you know. So for me, if it's good, it's still, you know, 30. This is overall 35 on the average of the three scores.
So far, I've not felt the need to shout at you too much. So, you know, we're starting out okay.
We've got to get this first one out of the way and just, you know, understand there's room to grow on top of something from 1960 that's a rehash of a song from 1916, which probably most of us didn't know existed until this point. So I think it's a good song, but yeah, it's a little charty type of song of the time. So overall, 35. We have got a little mention of this from our mum, Paul.
From mum?
Our mam.
Our mam, indeed.
She's very much, this is her kind of time, her generation of being a little girl, but she likes to say, tell us about how she could always quote...
Memorise the charts for her
older sister, and who used to make her recite them to her friends, because she had Auntie D's.
That's why you have younger siblings, is to make them do things for you.
Yeah. So I have got... I did ask mum about some of these songs, and this is what she had to say about this one. What do you want to make those eyes at me for?
What do you want to make those eyes at
me for?
I used to have his Emil Ford in the checkmate.
That's it, yeah.
And I had his autograph.
Oh, right.
Because he stayed at the Talbot and your grandma got me his autograph.
Right, well, there you go.
What do you want?
But you don't know where that autograph is now. Yeah, okay. So, yeah. There you go. She had the autograph, Paul.
So she had the autograph of Emil Ford. That's nuts, isn't it?
Yeah. That's...
So without revealing the entirety of our mum's backstory and history and all the places she lived and that, she mentioned the Talbot, which was a pub that was in Eston, which is a village in North Yorkshire, and then was in Cleveland and stuff like that, depending on where your boundaries go. The idea of Emil Ford, number one superstar Emil Ford, being in Eston. So he was staying in the Talbot. I don't know if that was... Mum will tell us, I'm sure. Maybe because our grandma used to work in a pub. So maybe it was that pub. I don't know. That's bonkers, isn't it? First one out of the gates as well. Mum's got a personal story about it.
Yeah, so we'll check in with Mum as we go along, our mam, Margaret, to see what... other things she might come out with as we go through these.
What's she going to come out with next?
Yeah.
Brilliant. So what's their overall score then, Gary?
I said 35, Paul. 35.
Did you? Sorry.
We're off the blocks with 35.
Right, okay. Yeah, I'm with you now.
So next song then, Paul. We're going now. We're in the flow. Next is Michael Holiday with Starry Eyed.
When we touch, I hear angels sing.
Starry Eyed.
When we kiss, I hear wedding bells ring.
Starry-eyed.
Can't explain what I feel inside, but I know it's love, true love at last. Oh, I'm starry-eyed, starry-eyed.
Starry-Eyed, Paul?
It's another eye-based song. It's a lot about eyes already. We've got, what do you want to make those eyes at me for? Now we're starry-eyed. And what we've got here is Michael Holliday, who is out of Liverpool.
Is he?
So he's our first Liverpool star.
Ooh.
Not our last, by any means.
So you're going to have trouble getting a link with him in the Beatles, then, I take it?
Well, I've got a link that I'm going to mention, which is not particularly jolly, I'm afraid, but I will mention it. So let me do the facts and figures about this. So this becomes number one on the 29th of January 1960. It's only at number one for 1 week.
Okay.
But it's produced by Norrie Paramore, who was the in-house producer for Columbia, kind of George Martin's rival, in the same overall company, but we'll get much more about Norrie Paramore as the years roll by in this exercise. That's a name you'll hear again.
Okay.
Written by Earl Schumann and Mort Garson. The B-side is a song called The Steady Game. And it's actually, this is our first proper cover of an American song.
Right, okay.
So it's not like the first one we've done, which is a sort of old tune that's been rehashed for a new market. This is a cover of a song by a guy called Gary Stites.
Right.
Which got to number 77 in America in 1959.
Okay, so this is this tradition that we talked a little bit about with some of the Beatles album tracks of kind of picking songs from America kind of hit parade and thinking, yeah, that might work okay over here, and just having a go at it and just redoing it for your domestic audience and your country. And
That very much happens. We'll see a fair bit of that as well, particularly at the start of the decade.
Do you think it's kind of like not easy pickings, but it's like a publishing catalogue. Well, you know, that made some waves over in America. So,
well, yeah. I don't think it's even that it makes waves, because you could hardly call number 77 waves. But it's a case of, we need a song for someone that's going to tap into that market of that particular sound.
Mm.
And it's rather cynically, some A&R person would have gone, well, what about this song here? This was done by a sort of teen idol. And even though I wouldn't describe Michael Holliday as a teen idol by any means, it's of that, it's like, well, that's popular in America, let's, you know, bring that over here.
Okay.
But yeah, this is Michael Holliday, or Norman Alexander Milne is his actual name.
I know why he changed it.
Yeah, Holliday.
Norman Milne is less...
it's not very dynamic, is it?
No.
No offence to any Normans or Milnes.
No, it's...
But it doesn't scream, you know, superstar. But he's our first Liverpool lad of the series, you know... He's got a very Liverpool story as well. He was a merchant seaman for a while, but he was doing talent competitions and winning. He got a Butlin's residency in Pathelli, which was, apologies for pronunciation of that, but that's a thing that a lot of bands from Liverpool would go down there, North Wales.
Mm-hmm.
He did the brilliant thing of writing to the BBC for an audition in the 50s.
Right.
Like, you know, and he gets signed off the back of that.
Wow.
And he's already had a number one at this point with a song called Story of My Life in 1958. And so he's a fairly big, well-known star, very much in the sort of crooner style.
Yes.
So even though he's covering songs by teen idols or, you know, wannabe teen idols, he's really quite a sort of smooth crooner.
Yeah.
And I will get this out of the way now, just at the top. He was born in 1924. He died in 1963.
Oh.
He struggled with mental health,
right?
Which at the time was sort of like people would say, oh, he's got stage fright.
Right.
But there was even an article when I was researching this from 1956 where he was described as sort of a newcomer who was, quote, very, very nervous. He was clearly always suffering from problems, and then issues with money and all sorts of stuff got on top of him, and he essentially dies from a drug overdose in 1963. So, yes, it is a sad story, really. And the sad sort of Beatles link to this is that the news reports of when he's buried, it's like 3,000 people turn up to his funeral in Anfield Cemetery in Liverpool. And it's like women and teenagers jostled one another, stood on tombstones and walked on graves to get a better look at the grave of the star who committed suicide last week.
Mm.
And the reason that there is so many people there, apparently, was because they had heard that the Beatles were there to carry the coffin, but it was only a rumour.
Oh, God.
So that's awful.
Yeah.
That, you know, the Beatles star was so big that people were spreading rumours like, oh, it's another Liverpool person, the Beatles will be there and all that.
Yeah.
And it just turns out this into this chaos at this funeral for this poor guy.
Hmm.
Yeah. So that's a very sad story there. And yeah, we'll move on from that now into what is actually quite a sweet record.
It's a nice song. It's a nice song. Shall I get onto my music notes then?
Yeah, please do.
We get what I like to call a Sandman style opening.
Mm.
That's kind of like arpeggio backing vocals, these bing, bong, ding, whatever.
Yeah, so sort of female backing vocal group doing these.
Yeah.
These,
it's like a vocal arpeggio, isn't it? Kind of going bong, 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 bong.
It's like they're doing a bell effect, aren't they?
So. Yeah, but it's really good because they're kind of like, they're kind of echoing each other. So they've really got that down. And I like that. It's a very interesting little effect. And it's followed with a kind of a samba rhythm and bass line.
I'd say it's like
a little shuffling samba kind of shuffle to it under a very melancholic, dreamy vocal. I mean, like, and I say dreamy, you know what I mean? He's barely letting this, he's got one of those voices that it's like, it's soft and strong all at the same time, if you know what I mean.
Like Andrex.
Yes, exactly. He's got an Andrex voice. It's super absorbent. No, it's
his heroes were the crooners.
Yes.
So apparently he recorded sitting in a chair. You know, it's that sort of level of effort.
Yeah, that very relaxed kind of style.
But he's got a beautiful voice. Yeah, well, more than anything, he's got a beautiful control of his voice. If you listen closely to the way he sings it.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You know, it's like the control of the air leaving. It's like it's the minimum to make that sound, which gives it a really kind of settled sound. It's very nice. And the female backing behind that kind of...
That's arranged really, really nicely, that female vocals. They're not just used for sort of repeating back words, although they are.
They do some of that as well, but
they do sort of like rhythmic parts behind the solo and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So whoever Norrie Paramore himself has got into sort of arrange this stuff, it's...
They've done a good job.
Done a good job, yeah. And although it's almost exactly the same as the Gary Stites version.
Right.
Except that Gary Stites does have more of a young voice, a more sort of teen idol voice. And then you've now got this version, but with this much more mature voice on it.
Which obviously made the difference, at least over here. It was not 77 in the chart, it was number one. And I think there's either a uke or a guitar that's shuffling along quite low in the mix there, just adding to that gentle but intricate kind of rhythm that's going on in the rhythm section. Something like that. And that lovely guitar joins with a tremolo effect. It's a really cool
good,
tremolo.
Isn't it?
Yeah, and has a great solo. And I think that mixes up with the backing vocals to kind of like...
That's the bit I really like.
It all melds, almost sounds like a synth at times because it's so locked in.
Like I say, those female vocals, because they're doing a sort of rhythmic pattern at that point, it does sound a little bit like a sort of block chord on a strange instrument.
Yeah.
Being used for sort of like played rhythmically to...
It is.
So it's a good effect.
Yeah, I really like it. It's gentle, fun, hypnotic piece with loads of interest and cool little touches and a great performance from all involved. I'm giving 50 for music.
That's so good. I mean, it's very, talking about 50, it's very 1950s.
Yeah.
And right, several of these early 60s ones are very much in the mould of the late 50s stuff. We've not started the 1960s with a... brand spanking new
people
approach
don't just,
to things by
yeah,
any
it
means.
It doesn't tend to work just because it's the first of a new decade to kind of go, right,
no.
we new music now. Like,
yeah.
Okay. But that's what I was saying about the last one, though, is that doo-wop people think of the last one. I like 50s stuff.
Yeah, me too.
But I like it more in the vein of this than I did the last one, more where they've got some kind of melancholy or minor chord in there. Those are the ones that I enjoy the most. Production, then, I think we've spoke about a lot of it. It's a doozy, really. I'm glad that after the first song, we're obviously not just going to get a long line of trebly echo. This covers a range with the lead vocalist kind of deeper tones cut against the treble, and the female backing is drifting nicely in the echo and blends nicely. So it could be used in a really interesting way, and it didn't have to be just a mushy treble, you know. So that lovely tremolo guitar as well, it's really good. And as I say, it all combines to make almost something new out of all of them combined. And there's these little bits of in the percussion that come through here and there, and it just carries it all the way through.
Yeah.
And the bass is great. The bass is really round and nice. I think it's probably a stand-up bass, isn't it, on this one, not an electric bass?
Probably, although I would say that one of the key things to remember here is that first one, if it was recorded by Emil Ford with Joe Meek, it would have been in a tiny studio somewhere.
Well, yes.
This is basically Columbia Records here. This is the top end of the British recording industry. We're talking Abbey Road type thing. We're talking a big studio. We're talking, you know, high-end session musicians.
But that vindicates me giving it 65 for production then, because that's because I've heard that difference in there, haven't I?
Yeah. But like I say, we're going to hear a lot more about Norrie Paramore in this series. He's basically doing what George Martin is going to end up doing for Parlophone, but for Columbia. But he's older than him, and he's sort of the guy that George Martin's looking at going, well, I want all the hits now. You've got so many of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, this record's got that sort of 50s sound. It's not close mic'd. It's not like a rock record at all. No. In fact, I don't think there's a snare drum on it, really. It's percussion. So it's ethereal. It's got that feel. It's interesting.
Good stuff. Right, let's go on to lyrics then. So, lyrics. Why am I so starry-eyed and mystified? Every time I look at you, falling stars come into view. Can it be that I'm in love? I think, well, my transcription went wrong there. Can it be that I am in love with an angel from above? I asked my heart replied, yes, that's just why you're so starry-eyed. Almost sounds like rap. That's
You do it, Stoke-on-Trent urban.
Yeah, when we touch, I hear angels sing.
Starry-eyed.
When we kiss, I hear wedding bells ring.
Starry-eyed.
Can't explain what I feel inside, but I know it's anymore. Love, true love at last. I know why I'm starry. Yeah, and a bit of a repeat.
I think the best bit is the starry-eyed, mystified rhyme. Quite like that.
Why am I so starry-eyed and mystified?
Because you have that double of the starry-eyed bit in there.
My favourite bit is the, can it be that I'm in love with an angel from above? I asked my heart replied, yes, that's just why you're so starry-eyed, because it does sound a bit like, the meter's good on it, actually. But I like the words for this music. It's a soft, idealised, romantic theme that sits in an innocent and gentle place, a little less kind of like, I've got you alone kind of feel to it.
It's very safe. And if you, the flip side of the single is a song called The Steady Game, which is a cover of a song by a guy called George Hamilton IV.
Right.
Who was a sort of country-ish rockabilly guy. And it's not much to write home about. It's quite melancholic again, even more melancholic than the first side. But it's a song about being, it's just about a song about commitment. Great.
Yeah.
You know, it's there's no one, there's nothing.
It is safe, yeah. It's all government endorsed.
Kind of.
Yeah. So nice, neat and solid rhymes. It's what it is, a crooner romantic song, but it's neat. So I'm giving it 40 for lyrics, which gives it 52 overall. So we've gone up a notch with this one. So we see if we can carry on the trend with the next one.
Go for it.
Next we have Anthony Newley and Why.
We found a perfect love. Yes, a love that's yours and mine. I love you and you love me all the time.
Why, Paul?
You asked me to do this, Gary.
Just why?
That's why. Yeah. Oh. Anthony Newley. Now, there again, this is a name we're going to come back to.
Yes.
I'm not going to say too much about Anthony Newley here because I could happily talk about him for ages. I don't know much about him, but every time I sort of look into stuff, it's always fascinating.
Yes.
But the song Why is number one on week commencing 5th of February 1960. It spends 4 weeks at number one.
Yeah,
I was found it quite hard to find who the producer was. It's probably Ray Horrocks for Decca, although it's not listed on any of the single sleeves or anywhere else, although I think I've sort of cross-referenced it with an album and stuff like that. Accompaniment from Johnny Gregory. It was composed by Peter De Angelis and Bob Marcucci.
Okay.
And it was a cover of a number one hit for Frankie Avalon. So again, this is a kind
American.
Of... Yeah, this import. Is kind of a, again, another British...
An American redo, a British redo of an American...
Yeah, it is, yeah. And this is more of a like, oh, it was a hit over there, let's do it over here. And we'll give it to Tony Newley, who I wouldn't call a crooner, but he's more in that mould again than being a teen idol.
Mm.
If anyone doesn't know Anthony Newley, he was born in 1931, died in 1999. He was a singer, a songwriter, an actor. He did lots and lots of musical stuff.
Yeah.
particularly with Leslie Bricusse, whose name I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. I'll figure it out if I'm not. But basically, together they wrote songs like Goldfinger, you know, the Feeling Good, the one that everyone associates with Nina Simone.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
And all the score and the songs for Willy Wonka.
And so, his biggest claim to fame, which is, of course, the best arrangement of Pop Goes the Weasel I've ever heard.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So he was very good at lots and lots of different sorts of things. He was also a star of one of the most bonkers TV series of the 60s, but I will talk about that when we talk about Anthony Newley again.
Okay.
But at this point in his career, he's had four singles out on Decca, and this is his first number one. If you want a Beatles connection,
yeah,
and I'm sure there's probably a few instances in the 60s, but he did a cover of I Saw Her Standing There that was released as a single in America and Australia late in 1963.
Okay.
And it's bloody awful. And also, for some reason, on the label of this, and I've looked on Discogs at a couple of different pictures of it, it's credited to being written by J. Lennon, L-E-N-I-N.
That's where they went wrong.
P. McCartney. They're covering a song by Lennon. it ends up on his album called Newly Delivered a few years later. But it's like a sort of big beat band arrangement.
Right.
It sounds like It's My Party by Leslie Gore for some reason. And he also does something in 1977. Again, I'm going to say for a future episode.
Okay.
But there you go. Yes, he's a very interesting person, Anthony Newley.
Yes, I'm sure he will pop up again, we think. Yes. So, music then. So this is a similar vein again, in that it's a romance kind of safe song, except that
I have those very words here.
Except the backing in this instance has been taken up by a contrapuntal xylophone, would you say, or glockenspiel? Which one is it?
I've gone for glockenspiel, I think. It doesn't seem to be ringing out like a vibraphone, but flipping it, there's a vibraphone on or a glockenspiel on this record, and you're going to know about it.
You're going to know about it, and some over the top kind of backing vocal / choir in places. You know, well, in the bridge and the chorus anyway, it's a little bit more jaunty and jangly, and I like the chord change in the bridge kind of / chorus section. There's a very interesting modulation there, very different. But when everyone starts joining in for the big third verse sing-along, it makes me think we should all be linking arms and singing in a school hall or something. It all goes a bit granddad, doesn't it, at that point? Why? Because I love you, it's like, I think the children's choir joins in or something. I don't know.
Well, Donny Osmond had a number three hit with this in the UK in 1972, and I suspect that would have been more along those lines. I didn't listen because I didn't want to.
No, but I can hear that very much. So,
yeah,
it's a simple melody in the verses, almost nursery rhyme or children's song-ish. Hence the big sing-along feel and the tinkly glockenspiel. It's not really trying to be anything else. It's got, I mean, he sings it nicely, and it's got some nice bits, but it goes very cheese very quickly, I think, kind of, but in a big kind of no apologies kind of way, I suppose. He sings it very placed, very precise, and it sounds, knowing mainly Pop Goes the Weasel, you can tell he's singing it restrained and basically trying to deliver it in this kind of little envelope of kind of, this is a little gentle song with a big sing-along chorus. But it's not my cup of tea, so I'm giving it 30 for music.
It's a funny one, really. Like I say, it's a cover of Frankie Avalon, and Frankie Avalon, again, is more in the teen idol sort of thing.
Mm.
And then they've given it to Tony Newley, who's got a very good voice, a great personality for delivering material, but then he's just doing a cover. It's like he's taken a really safe teen idol song and made it even safer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I don't know much about Frankie Avalon particularly. You know, he didn't have much success in the UK, but he was quite a big name in America. So his biggest song over here was a song called Venus.
Mm.
And I only really know about that song because it's used in the background of a scene in the Complete Beatles documentary film, you know, to illustrate how US stars had gone sort of very safe after the sort of, you know, neutered rock and roll when they were sort of like Elvis was too much. All that sort of stuff, and they come along with this wave of teen idols, and yeah, Frankie Avalon's Venus was used as a sort of illustration.
Right.
But I will say, actually, for 1959 into 1960 in America, that's this Frankie Avalon's version of this song was the number one that bridged the decades.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it's interesting. So yeah, they're grabbing these, like I say, they're grabbing these teen idol hits and they're giving to these very, I use this word very, very loosely, very normal performers over here.
Yeah.
But that's not really a fair word to apply to Tony Newley because he wasn't that normal in his career.
No. It's just this song is just a bit like... Da-da-da-da-da-da.
And also, it's only about 100 beats per minute, which is quite slow anyway. And it's also done with a half-time feel, so it's like really plodding.
Yeah.
Because it's dum, 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 dum. You know, it's that sort of feel, isn't it?
Let's talk about the production. The production isn't too bad. It has some... it has some spaces in it, you know, some places to fill. It's not laid on too thick, but it does then get filled when the backing kind of joins in, and they kind of open up. So they start off singing kind of oohs, and then they go into full R's, Paul. Full
R's.
And then when they go,
you know,
R's,
you're on a winner when you've got your full R's in full fling.
It's the over the bearing like backing ensemble. Overbearing backing ensembles when they really open up. That kind of American musical film from that era, kind of, it's just very full on. But again, I like the walking bass. It sounds so good. I'm sure it's another stand-up bass. It's making me really want my own stand-up bass because there's some lovely tones in them. There's some nice guitar chords that are coming through quite well. Can't complain too much. There's a lot in there to like, but I've given it 45 for production.
Yeah, again, it's Decca, so it's, you know, a fairly big studio.
Yeah.
Decca would release things that was brought to them by independent producers. All the companies
just
did,
as like
I think,
distributor.
But I think Ray Horrocks produced this as an in-house producer here. So I would imagine for the size of the orchestra.
It sacrifices some subtlety in many places, I think.
The B-side was a song called Anything You Want to Do, which is, do you know what, is a better song. It's more fun, it's more upbeat, and it's kind of got rock hints of rock and roll in there as well.
It gets another cover,
but, you know, it was never going to be the A-side in the marketplace they were putting out into.
Okay, so let's move on to lyrics then, Paul. I'm not going to go read all these lyrics because it's mainly why? Because I love you. There's something about that, because you love me, because I love you, that gets annoying in this. And there he's trying his best to sing it straight. It sounds childish somehow still because of the repetition. Like I say, all I get when I think of this song is because I love you. The simple childish rhyme, sweet treat, me, mine, love, time. It reminds me a little bit of kind of early Beatles words in a way.
Well, a lot of songs like that.
But because it's wrapped up in a jingle sounding kind of song. And without the focus, this makes him sound a bit naff, you know, because it's also against that slow, it's like Glockenspiel, safe, I don't know, I don't like it. 28 for lyrics I've given it. I don't know if you've got anything to say about the lyrics. There are
not particularly. I think you make a good point. It is quite nursery rhyme-ish, childlike, which is probably part of the success as much as anything.
Yeah, it's part of why there's that prevalent myth as part of the music industry of, you know, dumb stuff down, isn't it? But as the Beatles would go on to show us later down the line, along with other people, you can be a bit more challenging if you want to be.
I do think it's interesting when you can go look at a song or listen to a song and go, well, there's the feature that makes this the hit, or there's the feature that makes this the reason they've chosen it. And I think perhaps the lyrics in this one and that sort of sing-songy do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do stuff is probably what it is.
Yeah. Okay. Right. 34 overall it got.
Right.
So next we have Adam Faith and Poor Me.
Poor me. Oh, oh, poor me. Sorrow's heaving around my head. It's been heard and it's been said that you tried to date another guy. Didn't hide, didn't even try. Cheating me with lies again, making me remember when.
Poor me, Paul.
Oh, I'm sorry, Gary. I'm so sorry to hear you're suffering.
It's all right.
Or poor me, depending on where you're from, or poor me. It's one of those words that people get hung up on. But poor me, as in
poor, not me, very well, not pouring me into a cup.
No, not P-O-U-R.
Pour me is an O, pour me.
Pour some sugar on me, pour me. Yeah, Adam Faith, pour me. This, it becomes number one on the 3rd of March 1960. Spends 2 weeks at the top. Produced by John Burgess for Parlophone. Composed by Les Van Dyke. There's a name we'll come back to. B-side is a song called The Reason. And this is an original British hit, let's say. So Adam Faith, born 1940, died 2003. Actor, singer, and later financial journalist, strangely enough.
Okay.
But very well known name, Adam Faith, not just in the 60s, but through the 70s as well. He was a really key figure in early British rock and roll. You know, he's not like a slightly older gentleman, even if it's only a handful of years.
Mm.
You know, he's born in the same year as John Lennon.
Mm.
He's of that age.
Right.
I mean, this is his only entry in our list because it's his last number one.
Right.
But that's not to suggest his career didn't carry on, because he had quite a few more charting hits, like over 20 charting hits during the first bit of the 60s.
Right.
And people may know him from his big number one before. This was a song called What Do You Want?
Right.
Which is brilliant. Great song. But he's got that weird sort of Buddy Holly hiccup to his voice.
Yes. Yeah.
And yeah. So, but like I say, he was...
Oh.
He was quite well known as an actor as well. He was in quite a few films, and he made a series called Love Hurts in the early 90s. It was quite a big popular thing on TV.
Mm.
He played the lead in a thing called Budgie in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd actually retired from acting after he'd had quite a bad car crash. It took a long time to recover from. But then he goes back to music after that.
Wow.
And he puts out an album called I Survive, which features a few tracks with a chap called Paul McCartney on synthesizer. Mm-hmm. And Paul and Linda doing some backing vocals.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh.
So there you go. And do you want the link to Stoke-on-Trent?
Go on then.
That's where he died.
Oh, great.
There you go.
What's that?
I'll try not to make this too much of a parade of misery, but, you know.
No. Okay, I'm not going to ask why or how he was in Stoke and why that caused that or not, but whatever. Okay, then. So, let's go into the music for this. It's a strange beast, this one, isn't it? It's a strange Brazil-esque chord pattern that moves creepily up and down the chromatic scale and kind of surges.
Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's more like something else. It's very specifically like something else that's quite emblematic of the 1960s and beyond.
Bond?
James Bond.
Yeah.
And do you know who's doing the arrangement for this song?
James Bond?
James Bond himself.
Undercover?
Yeah, undercover as John Barry, who did the music, who wrote the James Bond theme.
Ah, so he's obviously...
So basically, he uses it here 2 years before it becomes, you know, the famous piece of music from Dr. No.
But in this one, though, it's not on the minor, is it? It's a major kind of chromatic movement.
Like, it's the James Bond theme.
Yeah, it's not got the creepy... it is creepy. I said the word creepy, but it's... Yeah, anyway. It's interesting. I can see where you're coming from. And Adam Faith does his funny bouncy vocal over it. He has got a funny voice, hasn't he? Another key change on this one, halfway through, I think.
Is it?
Yeah. I think it's got
probably
a key change.
If it's John Barry, it's probably got a
very
key
short
change.
Song.
So like we were saying, like 2 minutes and 3 seconds is short. This is 1 minute 46 seconds. It barely starts before it finishes. Yeah.
I'm not sure what to make of it. The weird surging backing vocals and frenetic snare again, which along with the pizzicato strings that could kind of accompany through it, combined to make a strange combo along with his bouncy voice. And the chorus is only slightly different to the verses. It's more of a sensation than a song.
Yeah.
I think it may be a bit... kind of Marmite, for want of a better analogy, you know, love it, hate it. I'm not finding it great. It's an interesting artifact. 35 I've given it for music.
I think it's interesting. I like Adam Faith. He's one of those ones, it's quite easy when you first hear like these early Adam Faith things to go, oh, listen to that funny voice.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's personality and it worked, you know.
Yeah, he got
but
his number one song. I mean, what?
Yeah, he got a couple of number ones. And I think the only thing is, this is almost so Buddy Holly in its arrangement and his delivery. They did come in for some flack. People were accusing them of sort of profiting off the back of you know, Buddy Holly no longer being around. You know, this is only a year after the day the music died, as it were.
Buddy Holly was doing, I know he was doing his odd kind of ballad, but pretty much he was doing rock and roll. This isn't rock and roll.
Well, no, but it does sound very Buddy Holly-ish. But,
yeah, he's singing it Buddy Holly-ish.
But this is, you know, this is written by a chap called Les Van Dyke.
Mm.
And I think we'll be hearing that name a couple more times, or possibly the name Johnny Worth, which is another name he wrote under, or his actual name, John Worsley. So he wrote loads of songs during the 60s and 70s and 80s.
Okay.
This song was originally called Poor Man.
All right.
And apparently music publishers were like, don't want that.
Right.
And so he turned it to Poor Me.
And they went, ooh, sounds, that's the ticket.
That's the one.
Okay, weird. So we go into production then.
Yeah.
The strings are a nice addition to this, changing between pizzicato and legato. Not sure I like the way it surges. I can't tell if it's a production or performance thing. It's all drowned in that kind of reverb to add to the dreamy overall effect, but they have left it off his voice. So he's kind of he's clear in the middle of it all, of the middle of the soup. Adam Faith is in the middle of the soup. It's okay. I can't complain too much about it other than that surging, because it feels like, I don't know if I like it, because it feels like the song is after me.
Well, that's it. That's the James Bond thing.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? But yeah.
Pursuit.
But it works.
Coming for you.
I want him to be after me when it's a drama, tense, thriller song track soundtrack. I don't want it to be after me when it's just a guy going, pardon me, kind of thing. I don't know. But it's interesting enough to give it 43 for production.
Yeah, it's very sort of studio band with voice. The strings are clearly the lead instrument. I mean, it's produced by a guy called John Burgess, and he was an assistant to a very well-known producer called Norman Newell. But he sort of took over a session for Adam Faith and produced a number one out of it. And so it's like, right, you produce Adam Faith now.
Yeah.
So he's one of the important record producers of the 1960s. He sort of joins up with George Martin and a bunch of others to form AIR, Associated Independent Recording, in the mid-60s. So that's a little story that'll thread through some of this about the independent record producers.
Excellent.
Just so there, it will.
Good. Okay, on to the lyrics then. I'm not going to go through all these ones again, because there's a few of them. But needless to say, the big hook is poor me, wah-ha-ha-ha-ho. It's quite a sad song, really. Poor me, ooh, boo-hoo, my girl's been a-cheating on me. Actually, no, it is quite sad, because it's my girl's been a-cheating on me, and the voices, why do they say sit and cry? The voices, why, oh, why do voices say to me, sit and cry? This was meant to be. What voices? A bit worried about Adam and the voices there. It's also a bit mixed, because it says, I hoped you might fall for me. But he used to hold her tight each night, so tight. And it says she cheated
on
him. That's right. And then he says she cheated on him. So she did fall for him, but then she fell off of him, as it were.
She fell off him. He'd been greased that night, and she just shot off. It's Adam a bit like Faith's greased arms.
Yeah, it's a bit like the first song in that kind of like, you know, you're not doing me right, girl, type of feel to it. So I'm going to give it the same kind of score for that, which is 35 for the lyrics to that, because I mean, it fits the song, but it's a bit like, I don't know. Yeah, it's all right. It just gives him I don't really that sympathetic with him. I don't think he feels he's that poor, really. Sounds like he just needs to get over it and move on with his life.
Yeah.
38 overall it gets. So, shall we move on to the last one, Paul?
Yeah.
Finally, we have Johnny Preston and Running Bear.
Running Bear, love little white dove, with a love big as the sky. Running Bear, love little white dove, with a love that couldn't die. He couldn't swim the raging river, 'cause the river was too wide.
Running Bear, Paul.
Oh God! What do I do? Do I make yourself large, or do I lie down and play dead? I don't know.
I think you punch it in the nose.
No, that's sharks. Running sharks.
No, punch it with a shark. That's it.
Okay. Oh, phew. Running Bear by Johnny Preston.
Yes.
Number one on week commencing 17th of March 1960. It spends 2 weeks at number one. Produced by a chap called Bill Hall. and composed by a chap called J.P. Richardson, otherwise known as the Big Bopper.
Oh, the Big Bopper. That makes some sense.
Who, obviously, we've already mentioned The Day the Music Died. He was one of the people who died in that.
Oh, so he produced this before he died.
Well, composed it before he died. Composed he couldn't it do before, it any other
yeah.
way.
Yeah. Obviously, sorry. I mean, had he composed
yeah,
this?
Yeah, I know. Well, I'll get into, I will get into that because there's a bit of weird sort of, not controversy, a bit of mix-ups, it seems like, in the history of this. It's released on a record label called Mercury. So this is an American import.
Okay.
So this isn't a British cover of anything.
No, it's
this is
just the actual American singing the actual song.
Yeah, so and it was a number one in America as well. Johnny Preston was born in 1939, died in 2011. American singer, basically given this song by the Big Bopper, which wasn't released until after the Big Bopper had died in that plane crash. So that was in February of 1959, although accounts vary. So I've got some news clippings about that. It was hit in the US and here. I mean, he had a couple more records out that did all right. But this is the real lasting hit. And I would say it's a novelty song, but it's also really cool.
Yeah.
There's a lot to recommend this song here. So in terms of Beatles links, Johnny Preston also did a cover of Leave My Kitten Alone in 1961. Which have then, of course, the Beatles record their own version of that, which doesn't appear until Anthology 1. And it seems likely that they both knew the original version of Little Willie John's Leave My Kitten Alone and Johnny Preston's version.
Right.
So, and then on the 12th of September 1963, they're rehearsing Hold Me Tight in the studio, and there's a bunch of studio chatter and they're talking about the beat of Hold Me Tight. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
And Paul describes the beat as being like Running Bear.
Yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
So he must be thinking of the riff rhythm.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's an interesting one. Let me just, I'll get the news clippings out of the way now here. So I've got an article from Disc Magazine, April 9th, 1960. Johnny Preston hits the top thanks to Big Bopper. It says, when Johnny Preston arrives in England tomorrow, Friday, he will be all set to collect his first silver disc presented to him by this paper. His first release in this country, Running Bear, has just passed the 250,000 mark in British sales. And so they ask him about the Big Bopper in this article here. So it's been one of the big hits of 1960, selling more than a million discs in the first 2 months of the year. Johnny was one of Big Bopper's closest friends. Quote, he encouraged me to record Running Bear, said Johnny. He said it was sure to be a hit as a new sound was needed. As well as writing the number, he did the A&R for my recording session, which would mean essentially the production. And yeah, the only problem is that I don't think any of the dates add up. It doesn't go into it in this thing here, in that I think he probably recorded this after February of 1959, in which case J.P. Richardson was not A&Ring the session or singing on it, which some people think he was. So,
right.
Just a little bit of, I think they were perhaps building in a bit of publicity there, tying it into his name,
right,
a bit wherever possible. So, but I don't know for definite. It's just it seems like that from what I can find out.
Okay, right then. Shall we have a listen? Oh, well, no, we've already listened. Shall I talk about
this? Just have another listen. Yeah.
So this is a very different one, and one that I can't be entirely sure should or shouldn't come with historical cultural warnings.
Oh, it definitely should.
Yeah, it should, shouldn't it? Yeah, definitely, yeah. Just checking. It's one of
those. Not in the lyrics necessarily,
no.
But just in the way it's...
Although I'm not sure of that either, be honest. Because how can we tell if those lyrics are... We'll talk about that in
Well,
lyrics.
I mean, yes, we'll get to that.
How can we, you know... So, yeah, we start with a kind of faux Native American chant.
Yes.
And then it kind of settles into an American South kind of sounding... I can't quite put my finger on it, almost... gospel-y type of melody, and it's really hard to figure out what.
Yeah,
genre
I mean, it's a
is.
Texas. It's a Texas production, essentially.
Yeah.
So
I got that right with the South. Then
yes, you were.
Yeah, and chords that break out into kind of rock and roll are very kind of the nearest we've got to kind of rock and roll, I think.
So
in this
far,
episode,
yeah.
Which would be very interesting if there wasn't just a slight undertone. Is this all right now? is it okay to be doing the Native American kind of sounds. Not, I don't know. Not that it's hard. It's a hard one. But this is some of the best rock and roll we've heard yet, you know.
It's a fun, yeah, it's a fun novelty approach to it. And I wonder how much of it, the rock and roll itself is considered to be a bit of a novelty aspect.
Yeah, because it's, yeah, because that's the different, that's the outlier, isn't it, at the moment?
Yeah, I would say actually that the chanting part of it as well, they could have done that with percussion and drums.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't have had to do that. But they, you've got the Big Bopper's influence.
You can hear
whether
that.
He's on, whether he's on it or not doing, you know, and Big Bopper's there as this larger-than-life comedy voice character.
Yeah.
You know, Chantilly Lace and all those bits and bobs around it. And that's clearly fed into his writing of this.
Yeah.
And that's perhaps what's made it a bit of a comedy song.
Yeah. And there's, like, some sax going mad over it and has a real breakout feeling in those sections, you know, in the choruses. Mm. And the guy's voice is great. The soulfulness in it during the verses is like I said, almost gospel-like. And then, again, the bass is great, the really good bass. It's just that chanting. I combined with the whole theme that I'm a bit... it's novelty, and I can hear why it was popular musically. So musically, I'm going to give it 45.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's definitely a cool song to listen to, and it's not offensive overtly in any way. It's just that it's just not okay.
It doesn't bear thinking about, yeah. That's the problem.
Production, not got much to say about production-wise. There's one of the production choices was presumably, let's have a bunch of guys pretending to be Native Americans. That, yeah. Unless I'm being totally unfair, and it really was a bunch of Native American backing singers doing actual...
I suspect not.
Yes.
I suspect not.
And the bass, it's an electric bass this time, I think. I'm pretty sure it's an electric bass. It's like nice and loud and
poppy.
Yeah,
it's hard to tell on some of these things where it's not as clear. I would have thought it would be for this one. I like this sort of production. It wouldn't be a big studio. It would be much more of a, you know, tapes running, boys, run it a few times. Yeah, all together type thing. Yeah. Step forward if you're going to be doing your bit.
And the it's the sax is actually bearable. This is the sax's happy place, novelty rock and roll romp. That's where saxes live. That's where saxes should stay. That's where saxes should never leave.
This could be construed as sexual harassment.
I hope people have listened the whole hour and 15 or whatever minutes it's taken to get to this point. Just to hear that joke. Those people who tail off before the end of the episode, Paul, they missed that. Yeah, I'm giving it 42 for production. That's all I'm going to say. Okay. It sounds good. So we have the lyrics. I mean, I'm not going to go through them because they're huge. And, you know...
Before you get into the lyrics, let me just point out that this is... What we've got here is in a trend of what they call death discs. Right. Or the teenage tragedy songs.
Right, okay.
So there's a whole bunch of songs that have this notion. There's another phrase for them that I like. It's splatter platters, which is great. Endless Sleep by Jodie Reynolds. Teen Angel by Mark Dinning. I love Teen Angel. It's a great song. Tell Laura I Love Her, Leader of the Pack. You know, it carries on through into the 60s. It's kind of basically, let's do Romeo and Juliet in a series of different settings.
That's exactly it.
There's normally cars involved or motorbikes, but in this case, it's not.
And I just want to say, you know, I don't want to sound massive, not that I don't want to, but if I'm sounding a bit right on and prissy in some ways, you just have to remember that using kind of Native Americans or any oppressed or minority group as a kind of cultural stereotype, even in a kind of fun, friendly way, just serves to kind of other them further, doesn't it? That's the problem.
Yes.
Even if it feels innocent and, well, what's the harm? It's kind of, well, it just makes them a little less real and valid if they stay as caricatures who run around campfires. You know what I mean? They may well do that, but that's where the problem comes in. And, you know, that's why people like Disney flag it in things like Peter Pan now. But, you know, we have at the middle of it an interesting vehicle for carrying lyrics, which is that tragic tale, Romeo and Juliet, two lovers divided by a literal river and rival families. They risk it all to be together and they die in each other's arms. I mean, we've heard that before, you know.
Hear it again.
Yeah, but with more poison and less rivers, you know, traditionally. It's a proper story. And I like the concept, it's just not the context. But I know that cowboys and Indians, as they were called then, called then in that culture, were just a part of life and growing up for white Westerners even ourselves as late as the 80s, Paul, there's even a picture of you in your little cowboy outfit in Cyprus with your little cap guns at your side, isn't there, Paul?
I look brilliant.
But it doesn't make it okay, Paul, no matter how cute you looked.
Yeah, our granddad on mum's side was a big fan of Westerns.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, although apparently he was always on the side of the, quote, Indians.
Oh, well, there we go.
So I don't know why what that means, but it's always interesting.
Just
that's the idea.
It's a huge part of culture. So it's, you know, you're not, it's not what the one of the worst parts of culture, is it? But it was just part of it. So, but they are the most interesting lyrics this week, but I'm going to dock them a bit for being a woke snowflake. So 45 for lyrics, which, while still the best this episode, I suspect won't be in the scheme of things for sure. And that gives it 44 overall.
Right, we've done it the first five.
Yes, so we have our first five. So do you want to hear the order for the first five, Paul?
I do.
At number five, we have Anthony Newley and Why. At number four, we have Emil Ford and the Checkmates. What do you want to make those eyes at me for? At number three, we have Adam Faith and Poor Me. At number two, we have Johnny Preston, Running Bear. And at number one, we have Michael Holiday, Starry-Eyed.
Ah, oh, the Liverpool lads are occupying the top spot already.
Yes. Yeah, it's definitely the best one this episode, isn't it? I think.
It's certainly, I'd say it's the most. Preston. It's the most professional, really, in terms of the whole package type thing, I think.
Yeah.
But again, a lot of this is down to taste, and there will be people who disagree with you, and they're right to do so and should tell you.
Absolutely. Please do tell me in the strongest possible terms. No, just do it in a nice way. Yeah, it's just for us to get talking. If you are listening to this for the first time and thinking, what are they on about? It's just for us. It's just the scores aren't really the thing it's about. That's.
What do you want to make those scores at me for?
Exactly. So it's been a big old long episode to get started. So we'll be back next week, but with four songs, I think, in the next episode.
Yes.
And we will see you then. And thanks very much for joining us. Goodbye.
60s, please.